Marva Collins. Most often when kids are behind, say when they're repeating a grade, they're given dumbed-down material on the assumption that they can't handle more. The idea comes from the fixed mindset. These students are dim-witted, so they need the same simple things drummed into them over and over. Well, the results are depressing. Students repeat the whole grade without learning any more than they knew before. Instead, Marva Collins took inner-city Chicago kids who had failed in the public schools and treated them like geniuses. Many of them had been labeled learning disabled, retarded, or emotionally disturbed. Virtually all of them were apathetic. No light in the eyes, no hope in the face. Collins' second-grade public school class started out with the lowest-level reader there was. By June, they reached the middle of the fifth-grade reader, studying Aristotle, Aesop, Tolstoy, Shakespeare, Poe, Frost, and Dickinson along the way. Later, when she started her own school, Chicago Sun-Times columnist Zay Smith dropped in. He saw four-year-olds writing sentences like, "See the physician," and "Aesop wrote fables," and talking about diphthongs and diacritical marks. He observed second graders reciting passages from Shakespeare, Longfellow, and Kipling. Shortly before, he had visited a rich suburban high school where many students had never heard of Shakespeare. "Shoot," said one of Collins's students, "you mean those rich high school kids don't know Shakespeare was born in 1564 and died in 1616? Students read huge amounts, even over the summer. One student, who had entered as a retarded six-year-old, now 4 years later had read 23 books over the summer, including A Tale of Two Cities and Jane Eyre. The students read deeply and thoughtfully. Heated discussions of Macbeth were common. Alfred Binet believed you could change the quality of someone's mind. Clearly, you can. Whether you measure these children by the breadth of their knowledge or by their performance on standardized tests, their minds had been transformed. Benjamin Bloom, an eminent educational researcher, studied 120 outstanding achievers. They were concert pianists, sculptors, Olympic swimmers, world-class tennis players, mathematicians, and research neurologists. Most were not that remarkable as children and didn't show clear talent before their training began in earnest. Even by early adolescence, you usually couldn't predict their future accomplishment from their current ability. Only their continued motivation and commitment, along with their network of support, took them to the top. Bloom concludes, "After 40 years of intensive research on school learning in the United States, as well as abroad, my major conclusion is, what any person in the world can learn, almost all persons can learn, if provided with the appropriate prior and current conditions of learning." He's not counting the 2-3% of children who have severe impairments, and he's not counting the top 1-2% of children at the other extreme that include children like Michael. He is counting everybody else. Ability levels and tracking. But aren't students sorted into different ability levels for a reason? Haven't their test scores and past achievement shown what their ability is? Remember, test scores and measures of achievement tell you where a student is, but they don't tell you where a student could end up. Falco Reinberg, a researcher in Germany, studied school teachers with different mindsets. Some of the teachers had the fixed mindset. They believed that students entering their class with different achievement levels were deeply and permanently different. "According to my experience, students' achievement mostly remains constant in the course of a year. If I know students' intelligence, I can predict their school career quite well. As a teacher, I have no influence on students' intellectual ability." Like my sixth-grade teacher, Mrs. Wilson, these teachers preached and practiced the fixed mindset. In their classrooms, the students who started the year in the high-ability group ended the year there, and those who started the year in the low-ability group ended the year there. But some teachers preached and practiced a growth mindset. They focused on the idea that all children could develop their skills. And in their classrooms, a weird thing happened. It didn't matter whether students started the year in the high or the low ability group. Both groups ended the year way up high. It's a powerful experience to see these findings. The group differences had simply disappeared under the guidance of teachers who taught for improvement. For these teachers had found a way to reach their low-ability students. How teachers put a growth mindset into practice is the topic of a later chapter. But here's a preview of how Marva Collins, the renowned teacher, did it. On the first day of class, she approached Freddie, a left-back second grader who wanted no part of school. "Come on, Peach," she said to him, cupping his face in her hands. "We have work to do. You can't just sit in a seat and grow smart. I promise you are going to do, and you are going to produce. I am not going to let you fail." Summary. The fixed mindset limits achievement. It fills people's minds with interfering thoughts. It makes effort disagreeable, and it leads to inferior learning strategies. What's more, it makes other people into judges instead of allies. Whether we're talking about Darwin or college students, important achievements require a clear focus, all-out effort, and a bottomless trunk full of strategies. Plus, allies in learning. This is what the growth mindset gives people, and that's why it helps their abilities grow and bear fruit. Is artistic ability a gift? Despite the widespread belief that intelligence is born, not made, when we really think about it, it's not so hard to imagine that people can develop their intellectual abilities. The intellect is so multifaceted. You can develop verbal skills or mathematical scientific skills or logical thinking skills and so on. But when it comes to artistic ability, it seems more like a God-given gift. For example, people seem to naturally draw well or poorly. Even I believed this. While some of my friends seemed to draw beautifully with no effort and no training, my drawing ability was arrested in early grade school. Try as I might, my attempts were primitive and disappointing. I was artistic in other ways. I can design, I'm great with colors, I have a subtle sense of composition. Plus, I have really good eye-hand coordination. Why couldn't I draw? I must not have the gift. I have to admit that it didn't bother me all that much. After all, when do you really have to draw? I found out one evening as the dinner guest of a fascinating man. He was an older man, a psychiatrist, who had escaped from the Holocaust. As a 10-year-old child in Czechoslovakia, he and his younger brother came home from school one day to find their parents gone. They had been taken. Knowing there was an uncle in England, the two boys walked to London and found him. A few years later, lying about his age, my host joined the Royal Air Force and fought for Britain in the war. When he was wounded, he married his nurse, went to medical school, and established a thriving practice in America. Over the years, he developed a great interest in owls. He thought of them as embodying characteristics he admired, and he liked to think of himself as owlish. Besides the many owl statuettes that adorned his house, he had an owl-related guest book. It turned out that whenever he took a shine to someone, he asked them to draw an owl and write something to him in his book. As he extended this book to me and explained its significance, I felt both honored and horrified. Mostly horrified. All the more because my creation was not to be buried somewhere in the middle of the book, but was to adorn its very last page. I won't dwell on the intensity of my discomfort or the poor quality of my artwork, although both were painfully clear. I tell this story as a prelude to the astonishment and joy I felt when I read Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. Looking at the before and after self-portraits of people who took a short course in drawing from the author, Betty Edwards, is amazing. At the beginning, these people didn't look as though they had much artistic ability. Most of their pictures reminded me of my owl. But only a few days later, everybody could really draw. And Edwards swears that this is a typical group. It seems impossible. Edwards agrees that most people view drawing as a magical ability that only a select few possess, and that only a select few will ever possess. But this is because people don't understand the components, the learnable components of drawing. Actually, she informs us, they are not drawing skills at all, but seeing skills. They are the ability to perceive edges, spaces, relationships, lights and shadows, and the whole. Drawing requires us to learn each component skill and then combine them into one process. Some people simply pick up these skills in the natural course of their lives, whereas others have to work to learn them and put them together. But as we can see from the after self-portraits, everyone can do it. Here's what this means. Just because some people can do something with little or no training, it doesn't mean that others can't do it, and sometimes do it even better with training. This is so important because many, many people with the fixed mindset think that someone's early performance tells you all you need to know about their talent and their future.